Our next speaker is Rory Ridley-Duff, who's going to talk to us about co-ops in the local economy. And here he is.
Hello. I've got a slightly different message, I think, but I'll try and respond to. I work at Sheffield Hallam University, so my connection to the cooperative world, I'm the course leader for a master's programme on cooperative and social enterprise management that's run out of business school, and the author of one of the textbooks that is now being used to teach social entrepreneurship around the world. But I'm still a practitioner. I do maintain my connection to practice by being involved in social enterprise Yorkshire and Humber, co-ops Yorkshire and Humber, and Viewpoint Research is a local social firm that helps with people who have been disadvantaged in the labour market. I'm not an expert on green jobs, but it obviously comes into discussions of fair trade, it comes into discussions of cooperative production, because quite a lot of cooperative production is agricultural and around issues of local energy. So I'll try to connect what I'm going to tell you about co-ops into the arguments that we've just heard. A lot of you will, the cooperative history goes back before Robert Owen, but a lot of people identify the Rochdale pioneers, who are the original founders of the cooperative group, and the work of Robert Owen, who was a thinker in the early 1800s, as the source of the cooperative movement. I don't think that's entirely true. I think it's also true that there was a whole movement of friendly societies. The friendly societies are what created the principle of one person, one vote. And Robert Owen, as we've been finding in a study group, was not necessarily an advocate of that. He was an advocate of education, he was an advocate of community integration and cooperative working, but the democratic underpinnings of the cooperative movement come from a different source. And those original principles that the Rochdale pioneers put into practice, the most important of which for the next talk is limited interest on capital and the way that capital is treated, are still recognisable. So in 1995, there was an international cooperative alliance that re-established a global set of principles that are propagated around the world in the cooperative world. So we still have the concept of open membership, which is basically that anybody who can and is willing to become a co-owner of the business should be able to do so. And that means that you can use it as a way of generating local ownership of the economy. Democratic member control is still there. Those principles are still there. There's quite a lot of sophistication around that now. As organisations scale, there are issues. So I just wanted to show the foundation. Now, key questions for today is just to introduce some of the models of the corporation, because there you'll find, the deeper you get into the cooperative movement, you'll find that there are different wings of it, just like there are different wings of any political system who argue for different models of cooperation. But I would argue that all of them are potentially helpful for creating an economy for the 99%. Key question is, where are the resources to develop co-ops? We live in a world that always looks to the state. Yeah, that's where I guess I differ. I think the cooperative movement encourages people to look into their own communities, into the resources that they already have, and make really good use of what I would call social and economic capital that they have locally. And limitations that is an entire cooperative economy realistic? It might be that there are certain aspects of economic development that are still better done by local government, by regional government, and perhaps by small-scale private enterprise. Now, there's an overarching argument I would make that I want to sort of leave you with, if I can, which is I think political change follows what is already happening. Politicians get hold of ideas that have already been generated for the last 15, 20 years. So you don't see political change or politicians picking up arguments until they've already been developed at the community level or at the societal level. Which means that we've got to build a new base first. Yeah? The first task, if you are, I think, a political activist, is to help change the economy in your area and hook up with other people who are doing it in their area, and then you will see a political superstructure being built on the top of that activity that takes place at the grassroots level. So, you know, don't go on the career path into political parties, come and join us. Cooperatives, one of the messages that's come out, it's the United Nations International Year of Cooperatives, and one of the things that they are putting forward is that it's a secret, it's one of the best kept secrets in the world. They've done fairly well in that there's about 1.4 million cooperatives around the globe. Collectively, the economy that they create is about as large as Spain, and it's been getting a raw deal in the press, but it's still one of the top 10 economies in the world. They claim around 1 billion members. It's about 1 in 7 of the world's population. So there are parts of the world where this model is quite dominant. Even in the UK, a lot of people don't know that they're a member of a co-op. They might get their car insurance from Nationwide. You may take your card down to the cooperative store. A lot of people don't realise that means that they're co-owners of those businesses. So it's a global movement, and the structure of cooperatives is much more geared to the needs of the 99% than the 1%, because, generally speaking, they do not allow external investors or absentee shareholders to take the profits out of the business. The profits get distributed to the customers, to the workforce, or to the producers who are providing the produce and selling it through cooperative retail stores, for example, or the fair trade movement. Now, they've done that in a world designed for private finance. So even if it's not as visible as we'd like it to be, if you begin to design the world to make it co-op friendly, I think you can expect to see very much more rapid growth in that economy. Now, there are three types of cooperative enterprise that I draw your attention to. Producer co-ops. These might be family businesses. These might be Jane. Yes? Whose family produce for their local extended family, and then they have a surplus. And they put that surplus into a producer co-op that then is sold into local markets, or maybe it's exported to Western markets. So the Co-op College estimate that 75% of the fair trade produce that you buy comes from producer cooperatives in the developing world. We can have a separate discussion of whether it's good to export them around the world, but providing that they're just selling their surplus rather than just producing for Western markets, I think maybe there is a good argument to keep supporting that. Oh, right. So. Consumer co-ops we're probably more familiar with. Most of us will know the co-op group, but I would draw attention to utility companies. What we're finding in parts of the continent is this is a very good model for your electricity, for your wind production, renewable energies. You can create them up as a community enterprise where the members of the community become co-owners of the enterprise and the profits go back into the community. That's a good model, and it's done very well in Denmark. It's doing very well in Scandinavia. In America, there are 42 million members of electricity cooperatives. In rural areas, most electricity production in America is through cooperatives, which is not well known. And lastly, employee worker cooperatives. So groups of workers who generally want democratic control. This is a very small part of the UK economy. There's only around 5,000-6,000 people, I think, who are employed in worker co-ops. But in Spain, in particularly in the Basque region of Spain, they've got one corporation that's got about 80,000-90,000 worker owners. And we shouldn't forget John Lewis in this country as well, that again has around 70,000 partners who co-own their own business. So it can scale, and it can be. The customer service levels are often very, very good out of employee cooperatives.
Haven't you forgotten housing co-ops?
Oh, there's loads more. There's credit unions, but housing co-ops I would see as a form of consumer co-op. It's owned by the people who are tenants. Yeah. So there's credit unions, which I will come on to, which are also a form of consumer co-op. But John Burchell, who's he's in Scotland, he would say that there are basically three underlying types, which then get propagated in different parts of the industry. And you also get hybrids. So you get those that are owned by both the workforce and the consumers, or the producers and the consumers. Yeah. Yes. Now, there's a question that I always think works well when I do it at school. I don't know how many of you follow football. Do you want to be a Barcelona or an Arsenal? John's an Arsenal supporter, aren't you? So. But the question is, do you want an economic model that spreads membership? So Barcelona in 2006 had 142,000 members who own Barcelona Football Club. They now have 170,000 members. Arsenal in 2006 had four people who owned 87% of the shares, and today they now have two that own 96% of the shares. So you've got different models that distribute power and wealth, or accumulate or concentrate power and wealth. And it's not accidental. You know, it might not be that people want it that way, that's just the way it happens. Yeah. And of course, if you were one of these shareholders, you would think, you'd tear your hair if the season ticket prices were that cheap. But of course, it's owned by the fans. So because it's run for the fans, the wealth stays in the pocket of the fan rather than goes into the pocket of some absentee shareholder, or probably not an absentee shareholder in the case of football. But they tend to like to watch their team
play. I can't read those numbers, Rory. What does it say?
£69 for the cheapest adult season ticket at Barcelona. This was in 2006. £885 at Arsenal. Most expensive ticket at Barcelona, £579 at Barcelona, £1,825 at Arsenal. So the most expensive season ticket at Barcelona is cheaper than the cheapest season ticket at Arsenal. Okay. I don't know what you paid. You got the ticket? Yeah. But you know, the point is, what kind of economic model do you want to generate? And of course, Barcelona shows that you can achieve world-leading excellence using a cooperative model, and it's deeply embedded in its community and works with its local government, its local financial sector, and they have 2,000 fans who are randomly elected, who can kick the board out if the board isn't doing what they want it to do. Yeah.
How much are their players paid compared to Arsenal?
Now, that's a good question. I can't answer, but I'd like to know. I'm sure the wages are not so different. And that's one of the criticisms. But it misses the point of that it's run for the benefit of the community and the fans. I imagine Arsenal also do a lot, but we can see that a lot of the money is probably not going back into the fans. It's going to be run for the benefit of the people who own it.
Basically servicing debt.
Could be, yeah. Combined building that stadium, yeah. Now, how might you challenge sceptical friends? Because a lot of people say co-ops, you know, they're small, they're irrelevant. You know, I'll give you a couple of examples, but a few more for you. The co-op group is top 10 in size of UK companies in any sector. 7 million owners, it claims. And it's listed in what's called the CRF International List of Top Employers. This is a list of 67 companies globally that are recognised as top employers for career development, training, corporate social responsibility, wages, conditions of work, etc., etc. So it's a good place to work. As is John Lewis, also in that list. It's the third largest private business in a Sunday Times top attract list. And I don't know what the criteria are for this top attract list. But they have 81,000 partners, yeah? Owned by a trust for the benefit of the employees. I'm not sure what its environmental stuff is like, and it'd be nice to know. Yeah, Arup is an engineering company which, you know, I know it was built the Bird's Nest Stadium in China for the Olympics, but it also built some of the buildings in Sheffield for Sheffield University. It also built an entire campus for York University. So this is, again, is another one owned entirely by a trust for the benefit of employees. And lastly, the Mondragon Co-op Network. And I would urge you, many of the Mondragon Co-ops have ISO 1400 Environmental Management Certificate for certification. I'm not sure what people feel about that certification, but as I understand it, it is the international standard for environmental responsibility. So they take their, you know, they are industrial, a lot of them are industrial, so it's good that those industrial businesses are taking environmental responsibility very seriously. But again, they have another aspect, which is they have the highest, according to one source, they have the highest percentage of female managers in any European large business. So that's something to look at. And right at the heart of their model is education. This is the corporate model. Oops, sorry. The corporate model for Mondragon is based on education and the sovereignty of labour. So this is where there's a possible connection into the trade unions here. And they've begun to make connections with America. They've got an agreement with one of the biggest trade unions in America to invest in enterprises which are labour controlled. And we're trying to set up a project to transfer knowledge into northwestern Europe. It's one of the things the university is involved in. And if that occurs, there'll be a chance to maybe make connections and see if we can get their expertise much more into the countries of Ireland, France, Netherlands, the UK, Scotland, Wales. The reason they often get talked about a lot is they manage, for reasons that aren't fully understood yet, to maintain a very high proportion of worker owners compared to worker cooperative movements in other parts of Europe. In Italy, the worker ownership is around 20-30% of the workforce. It's 85% of the workforce at Mondragon, which is healthy for the where the wealth goes. The wealth goes back into the community and it remains local. They talk about no Porsches, no poverty, where the Mondragon operates. So to sort of draw the talk to a close, I want to look at reframing the concept of capital. And the first way is to talk about social capital. Social capital is a concept about the wealth that is embedded in networks of people. Yeah, I don't know how many of you have seen the film It's a Wonderful Life. And there's a bank run in the middle of It's a Wonderful Life, and the owner of a credit union goes in and he uses his own money that he was going to go and spend on his honeymoon to make sure that the credit union members don't leave and go and put their money into the private bank around the corner. And that scene is very powerful because he communicates to them how they're all investing in each other and how they're all helping each other in order to make the argument that it's a better way, it's better to keep their money in their credit union than to go back to the private banks. So trust, reciprocity, and mutuality are sort of core concepts that underpin the creation of social capital. And in terms of wealth creation, Bourdieu is a French theorist who says you cannot create a wealthy economy without trust, reciprocity, and mutuality. And therefore, we're seeing a drift towards distrust, lack of reciprocity, lack of mutuality. And therefore, that's why we're seeing a lot of the things that we're seeing in the world that we have today. Now, this is where I begin to disagree with the argument that we should look to the public sector all the time, because I think we should look to the social economy. What this is called is the social economy. It's not just public and private. It's public, private, and social. And the social economy looks into the resources within the community and builds those up. And I want to draw attention to credit unions. Because credit unions are very definitely the foundation on which you could build an economy for the 99%, is my view. I've just come back from a very interesting trip to Indonesia, and I was absolutely staggered, I think, at how socially advanced they are in their thinking, even if they're economically catching up. And they organise groups of people into 15, 25 families, individuals. It's built on friendship, trust, and family. These are people who know each other, who make a mutual commitment to support each other. And then they save together. And if they collectively go and try and borrow money from someone else, they will sort of help each other if one of them gets into difficulty. So you create a social group where there's a lot of communication about what's going on in those people's lives. And doing this, they've managed to reduce the interest rate at which they borrow down to 1% to 2%. Yeah? Staggering.
Is that because they've reduced the risk?
Yes, that's right. There is almost zero default from if you collectively are applying to borrow money from another source, which is usually the accumulated capital across lots of these groups. They create a second tier where they pool their shared resources. The risk of default is so low that they can lend it back at 1% to 2%. And people will use that money for lots of things, you know, putting their children through education, finally getting themselves a house. It's similar to early building societies. Early building societies I discovered through looking at work at the Open University. They only used to be 10, 20 people. They couldn't afford to buy a house themselves, so they get together in a club, they pool their money, they build the first person's house. When they built that, they pool the money again, and when they've built the house for everybody, they shut down the building society. Yeah. The idea of keeping the building society going was something that sort of came later. So I've just found there's a book about this, and I'm going to read that as my summer reading.
It's also very similar to Islamic finance.
It is.
In the way that the Asian community in Britain share.
But we have quite strong credit unions locally. South Yorkshire, Leeds, are good sized credit unions, and if we can engage in a dialogue, one of the things we might want to do is engage in a dialogue about whether we can reproduce this here. We've also discovered through a project with the Pakistani community that this is going on in Sheffield at street level. So we've got something to build on.
In Sheffield, it's Birkendale.
Birkendale?
Near Commonside, Land Reform Society, 1848.
Right.
Perfect example.
They're doing this.
No, they did it in 1848.
Right. Oh, right. Yes. Thank you. Do let me know about that. Slip that into a lecture somewhere. The other thing, of course, is where does the economic capital come from? In the UK, we've been hamstrung by the fact that credit unions have only been able to lend to individuals. You go to Spain, you go to Italy, you go to other cooperative economies, the cooperative businesses are also part of the cooperative system. So you're not just getting individual incomes going into the credit union, you're getting the profits from cooperative mutual businesses going into the credit union as well. And there are a few things that are strange about the UK. I mean, as a person who worked in a co-op, my local co-op development worker told me not to go to the co-op bank, because the co-op bank did a really poor deal for cooperative businesses. I don't know why. But the law has just changed, and it's not something that will inevitably happen, that credit unions will begin to attract cooperative or mutual or social economy customs, but I think it's part of the conversation we should seek to develop to see what can be done locally. Maybe have a city strategy for it. So the financial systems in co-op economies elsewhere are definitely worthy of study. The other thing is that bona fide co-ops, it's a legal phrase in the UK, bona fide co-ops issue shares, and not to be afraid of share issues. We're going to hear some good examples from Sheffield Renewables, from Regal is about to do a community share issue. Community shares are the way that communities take back ownership of their shops, their pubs. There's a Hudswell pub in North Yorkshire that received a lot of publicity because they took ownership of the pub, started growing local food, added a shop on the end of the pub, which is now selling the local produce. So they're hooking up different parts of their community to regenerate local production. Mutuals. I'm a fan of mutuals in some contexts, but mutuals typically don't issue share capital. Everything is indivisibly owned, commonly owned. Yeah? I think there's an argument for both in different circumstances. So, what can we do? Form, develop, build social networks. This is a good social network. This is terrific. Enterprising ideas come out of the conversation between people in the networks. And then, of course, how do you get that to go forward is another question. I think the university has a role to play in helping that happen. High-quality relationships. The reason those interest rates were so low in Indonesia was people could depend on people fulfilling their mutual or reciprocal obligations in those lending, savings and lending groups. The more you trust each other and the more you support each other, the lower the risk, and that's a cooperative advantage and a competitive advantage relative to the private economy. Economic capital retains, it's an interesting point, retained surpluses is the cheapest form of finance. Mm. You need a good business model in any enterprise. You do not have to pay for the money that you retain. Now, I know that means talking about profits, yeah, but it is the best source of finance for development if you have got a model that generates a surplus, that you minimise the amount you have to go out and get money from other people. I think the next best option is community shares or offers of equity to employees, yeah, because these are people who are buying into you for the long term. Yeah. And then the next best is we've got a whole stack of community finance organisations developing. Triodos Bank, Charity Bank, Unity Trust Bank is the co-op movement and the trade unions. Key Fund is a good community finance organisation based in Yorkshire. There's one called Bridges Ventures and Big Issue, and Baxi is a specialist in employee ownership. There are lots of these institutions that are now developing that can help when you've got a plan that you want to try and take forward. But I would say, don't forget your own capacity to generate your own development capital. Last but not least, there are some well-researched limitations to cooperatives. Startup rate is low, yeah? And I think that's inevitable. If you're looking at getting a group of people to start a business, it's going to take longer and be more difficult than if you've just got one person who's going into self-employment. You can expect much faster rate of private enterprise creation than cooperative enterprise creation. But I think there are ways past that. We've developed a model at Sheffield Business School where you can create an enterprise with a single person starting time, but the rules are such that each person you take on becomes a member of the company, not just an employee, or not an employee. In other words, the structure of the company builds cooperative membership of an enterprise rather than employer-employee structure. So I think there are ways you can accelerate that. That said, the risks are pretty low. When co-ops start, their survival rate is very good in the first 1, 2, 3 years. But the risks rise. Private businesses, they drop. This is based on a study of French co-ops and French private sector. So I don't know if that holds true in the UK, but I would suspect it would. There seem to be good reasons for that. But the omens are good, because if you get past the 5-year barrier, cooperative businesses, the risks fall back below private businesses. So they're good at the beginning and they're good long term, but it takes some effort to learn democracy, yeah, to learn to manage a business in a democratic ethos. And some of them revert to private ownership because they can't learn it, yeah, or they can't create the institutions to manage it. So again, that's another place that all sorts of people in the education world can help. Including people in local government, I think. They have experience of how you run things when you've got constant sort of adversarial conflict between different interest groups and things. The other thing is scale. They do scale. We've seen Barcelona, we've seen Co-op Group, we've seen Mondragon. But is it the case that it should always be seen as a preferable option to local government or national government? I'm not convinced enough. That there are some things that local councils will do better than mutuals or private businesses, and there are some things on a national scale that, you know, the state bodies might do better. So I think it should always be an evaluation as to where it goes better. Yeah. Sheffield Business School, ways we can help. We're hosting 4 cooperatives, Yorkshire and Humber, the Futures North Conference. It's actually run by Co-ops Yorkshire and Humber, but we're acting as the hosts, and that's on the 23rd of June. Very inexpensive, £20 if you're a member of a co-op, £40 otherwise. Come along and see what the local cooperative economy is doing and developing. We run summer school. This is a bit more expensive because we run it on a non-loss basis, which means that we've got to pay for the lecturers to come. I'm one of them, but we have two others. Gareth will be another one who's going to speak later. And our third is Cliff Southcombe, who runs Social Enterprise Europe. Yeah.
Just now you said if you're a member of a co-op, does that mean if you have a co-op card that you give where every time you go in a co-op, you're
possibly.
So
yes,
okay.
So you can check the courts. There's a well, that if these slides, if Oliver, I don't know if you can email the slides around. That goes through to
website.
Yeah. All of these are links that go through to websites where you can book. Yeah.
Just to say, the cooperative group is now a member of Consortium Number.
Yes.
So, the answer will be yes.
Yes. Yes. That's great. We're also running, I don't know if any of you are involved in council, Sheffield Council or other councils, but we're running, again with Yorkshire and Humber, a cooperative council's open day, open space. So it's a particular approach to getting small groups together. Am I overrunning 15 minutes?
You are, yes.
Sorry, something like that. And there's information. I've got a few sets of slides here if you want. There's some more slides on the table out there. And there's some information about a master's course as well as the summer school that's mentioned. Okay. Right. Thank you for
your time.